Welcome to the Why Did I Get Cancer podcast. I'm Deborah Herlax-Enos, a small-town girl turned TV nutritionist and healthy living expert. I design health programs for the average guy or gal, including those average guys named Metallica. On September 1st, 2020, I was diagnosed with breast cancer. I asked every oncologist the same question, why did I get cancer? But none of my doctors had good answers for me. I wanted answers, and that's why I started this podcast. I want to help you to lower your cancer risk and provide self-care tips for those in the battle. I'm getting answers, and I want to share them with you. Welcome to my first episode of something I'm calling Cancer Crime Stories. I know a lot of you listen to crime stories. I have a friend, and she loves Crime Junkies, and she actually will even listen to it before bed, which it would, I think it would freak me out too much to do that, but she loves it. So it started me thinking about cancer crime stories and what we have done to people by dumping toxins in water or, you know, chemicals in the air, and how that eventually ends up making us sick. So today is my first episode, and I interviewed Kate Moore, who is the author of a story called Radium Girls. Radium Girls, this was set in the 1920s. These girls were as young as 14, and they were hired by this radium factory to paint radium on watch dials. They were called the dial painters because it was fluorescent. But it was fluorescent because it was radiation, which could kill them. They were also encouraged to, when they dipped their paintbrush in the radium paint, that to get a nice pointy end on the paintbrush, to stick it between their lips, which eventually ended up killing them. So please join me for my first Cancer Crime Story podcast. I'm going to be releasing these once a month. I am so fascinated by these topics and what we've learned after multiple lawsuits and people getting really, really sick. Have we learned to tell the truth to people so that we are not dumping things in the environment and we give people enough information so that they can make an informed decision? So again, please join me today. I think you're going to really be mad about this podcast, but also so intrigued that you won't be able to stop listening. Enjoy. Oh, today's podcast is such a departure from my normal podcast of interviewing oncologists and health experts, because today I'm speaking to Kate Moore. She's the author of a book that I loved and was horribly disturbed by, called The Radium Girls. And I basically wanted to have this podcast to talk about basically a cancer crime story. I mean, crime stories are so popular right now. And my thoughts were, oh my gosh, we commit crimes with the chemicals that we put into the environment we don't tell people about. And when I read Radium Girls, I thought this is absolutely this category of a cancer crime story. So Kate Moore, welcome from the UK to Why Did I Get Cancer? And I guess, would you like to give us a little bit of background about the Radium Girls, but also why were you so intrigued by this story that happened in the US and you're based in the UK?
Yeah, a lot of people ask that question because, as you say, I'm, you know, entirely British. It's where I was born and raised, where I still live to this day. And this is an American story. It's an American historical story. So my book opens in 1917, just on the cusp of America joining the First World War. And the story of the Radium Girls, in a nutshell, is it's the story of the American women from the First World War and a little bit later into the Roaring Twenties, who used to paint clocks and watches with glow-in-the-dark radium paint. Mm. And they were taught to lip point, to put their brushes, their paintbrushes, between their lips to make a fine point for this delicate handiwork. And as you can imagine, they are swallowing this glow-in-the-dark radium paint and they get sick. And it's a story that is not only about a cancer crime scene, as you say, it's not only a story that is about sickness and sacrifice. It's also a story of strength and fighting for justice and leaving a legacy and fighting for what you believe in. And I was drawn to the story initially because I directed a play about this story, and it was the most serendipitous journey of my entire life. I had only directed one play before, which was Lorca's Blood Wedding, and I loved the experience so much that I was sat on my sofa in London in the spring of 2014. The play that I directed had just closed, and I was like, I really want to direct another play again. You know, I really enjoyed that experience. And so I Googled great plays for women. You know, female director, I wanted to put on a play that had female protagonists, gave great opportunities to actresses to play great parts. And a play that came back on that random Google search was called These Shining Lives by Melanie Marnich. And it's about the dial painters from Ottawa, Illinois. Wow. And I fell in love with the script. I thought, you know, this true story sounds an amazing true story. I ordered a copy of the script. I read just the opening monologue. And I turned to my husband and I said, this is the play I'm going to direct next. My connection to this story was that immediate. And so I was lucky enough to put the play on, knew it was a true story. So I did lots of research to make my theatre production authentic. And through that, I discovered that there was no book that was actually about the Radium Girls, the individual Radium Girls who had gone on this incredible journey, who had sacrificed so much, who were these, you know, unwitting scientific pioneers who've left us an incredible scientific legacy, who've, you know, just left such an extraordinary mark on the world. There was no book that was about them. And I just thought that was so wrong. I thought these courageous women deserved a book that was about them, that paid tribute to them, that walked in step with them on their journeys and told their personal intimate stories. I wanted them to be remembered. And so ultimately I thought, if no one else has written this book that I think should be in the world, even though I'm British and this is an American story, you know, why don't I do it? And that is how the book came to be, and how I, a British author, ended up writing this American story. And I'm so grateful to you for having me on today to talk about them, because the whole mission for me in writing this book was, you know, to ensure that these women were remembered. And that's what we're doing today. We're remembering them and telling their story so that other people, you know, will have their memories in their hearts again, which is just so special.
It's so special. So you've really become their voice, because this was 100 years ago that this occurred. And I'd like to think that things have changed in the world and we're telling the truth more to employees and people who live in communities where there might be toxic waste. But can you tell me a little bit about why weren't these girls protected? Did anybody know that radium was dangerous at that point in our history?
Well, that's kind of the million-dollar question. And the simple and the short answer is that, yes, we did know it was dangerous. So as I say, my book opens in 1917, when the dial painters are going to work and painting these dials. Radium was first discovered by the Curies in December 1898. Okay. So it had been around for about 20 years, we'd known about it. And even by that point, the Curies had realised that it was very dangerous. I think it was around 1903, Pierre Curie said he would not trust himself alone in a room with a kilo of pure radium, because it would burn all the skin off his body, destroy his eyesight, and probably kill him. That's what he said. So people knew that a large amount of radium was dangerous and indeed fatal. And you have this crazy situation where the lab workers at the radium firms, the lab workers who were handling large amounts of radium, they are issued with safety equipment by 1917. They have to wear lead aprons. They have to use ivory-tipped forceps to handle the radium. And literally, like, on the same site in the dial painting studios, you have the girls putting their paintbrushes laden with radium paint between their lips. What had happened, to explain this kind of crazy situation, is that quite early on, they knew radium could destroy human tissue, but it was used to brilliant success to treat cancers. So they could use the radium, and in fact they still use radium today, a different isotope of radium than they were using then, but they still use radium today to treat cancer because it's very effective. And what had happened in the sort of lore of radium is that people thought, well, this is remarkable that, you know, this miraculous substance is saving lives because it was successfully treating cancer, which, you know, just seemed miraculous. And this craze sprang up around radium because people thought, well, if it can beat cancer, what else can it do? And so people started experimenting, and they had this theory that a tiny amount of radium was beneficial to health. The complete flip side. And as I say, it was relatively early. You know, we're only talking about 20 years since it had been discovered. And in that 20 years, entrepreneurs sort of launched into this sort of absence of true knowledge about radium. And they filled it with products. They filled it with radium butter, radium toothpaste to give you a brighter smile with every brushing, radium chocolate, radium health tonics. You know, if you're feeling a little bit middle-aged and under the weather, you know, have a little radium shot and it will pep you up. And these products were everywhere. They were in the local drugstores. They were all over the world, you know, pharmacies in London, you know, the streets of Ottawa, Illinois, or Newark, New Jersey. You know, this was marketed as a cure-all, and it was used, as I say, as a sort of vitamin to try and pep you up. But it was also used to treat things like gout or hay fever, constipation. People thought it was, you know, the next coming. And in fact, I found material, you know, in the archives and the newspapers and things that doctors and scientists were wondering, you know, is radium the key to human immortality? There was an article in the Newark Evening News from the early 1920s saying in the future they thought readers would be eating radium tablets because doing so would add years to our lives. They thought this was going to be the thing that was going to help us live forever.
And yet, the scientists and what I'd also read, what the owners of these factories were protected with lead aprons.
Yeah, that's because they knew that a large amount was super dangerous. They thought that a small amount was safe, but when you start digging into why do they think a small amount was safe, it was because of research conducted by the radium firms making money from all these products. That was why they thought it was safe, because of this early scientific research that, as I say, it hadn't, there wasn't much longevity to the research, but it was also funded by the people who were looking for positive results.
I always say follow the money, and who has a horse in the race?
Exactly.
So based on research conducted by these radium factories, they deemed small amounts safe. So when they told their female workers, it's okay to dip your brush in the radium paint, and then you want to get a nice point on your brush, so you stick it between your lips. And they felt that that would still be a small amount, even though they were, I'm imagining these girls, you know, people worked longer hours back then, right? So probably a 10-hour shift. So how many times per hour were they sticking that brush in their mouth?
Well, exactly. You know, the fastest workers would do 250 dials a day, you know, and there's obviously 12 numbers, you know, all the way around on a clock. Different workers did different things, but I would say probably from looking at what the girls did, it was probably every two numbers they put the paintbrush back in their mouths. So over 250 dials every day, that's a lot of paint that's going in. I mean, it is fair to say it was a tiny amount of radium. Radium at that time was the most expensive substance on Earth. So for a single gram, that would sell at the time for about $120,000. Oh, but that is $2.2 million in today's values. So it was, it was, you know, more expensive than gold. It was just, this, as I say, this wonder element that everyone was thrilled by. And so the girls, it was a tiny amount, but that tiny amount still leaves an impact when it's a radioactive material that you are swallowing day
after day.
And
especially, you know, because the Curies also said, don't even want to be in a room with radium because it will melt your skin
and
off.
And they, the Curies didn't know about this lip pointing technique. They found out in the decades later, and Madame Curie was said to be, you know, horrified to learn that this is what the workers have been doing. And it's important to say have been told to do. You know, this is how the women were instructed. You know, my book opens with a young woman called Catherine Sharp, just 14 years old when she goes to work on this, you know, February day, 1917. And she's instructed to put the brush in her mouth. That's how they were taught to do it.
Yeah.
And at 14, most of the girls were teenagers, actually. That's right. The sort of demographic. They were poor working class families. They were, many of them were teenagers. And that was, you know, where they were drawn from. And, you know, the girls did say when they were told to put the brushes in the mouth, they said the first thing we asked was, does this stuff hurt you? But they were assured that it was safe. And they had no reason to doubt the company because, as I say, they knew from newspapers, magazines, the local drugstore, that radium was seen as this wonder element. And they thought they were lucky to work with it. You know, not only was it seen as healthful, but it was incredibly glamorous. You know, it was this, you know, almost like fairy dust, you know, this glow in the dark dust. And some of the girls that I wrote about said they used to wear their good dresses to the studios because they get covered in the glowing dust from the paint. And then they'd go out to the sort of speakeasies and the music halls and they'd be shining and shimmering on the dance floor. You know, they were encouraged to practice painting. So they'd paint their fingernails, you know, the buttons on their dresses. You know, it was glamorous. It was artistic. In the local town directories, the women are actually listed as artists. That was like the job title in the town directories. And it was really well paid. It was one of, you know, they were in the top 5% of female wage earners nationally, earning more than, more than three times the average factory floor worker in that era. So it was very, very well paid. And they thought they were so lucky.
They were rock stars.
To get
they were rock stars of of their era.
Yeah.
And I'm sure, you know, if I was 14 years old and I was from a poor, you know, working class family, you are instantly elevated to this incredible status. Why would you ever turn down a job like that?
Exactly.
What are some of the... what have you seen with radium impact? You know, what are some of the symptoms that these girls started to experience, and how quickly did they start to experience some of these symptoms?
Well, one of the confusing things about what happened is that it turns out that radium poisoning is incredibly insidious. So it literally takes years for it to show itself. So most of the women don't start to get sick until maybe about 5 years later. For some, it was even longer. And again, it starts very innocently, an aching tooth, a sore back, you know, a painful foot, maybe a little bit of a limp. And the other confusing thing is that it affected different women differently.
That.
So, yeah, I've described, obviously, you know, various different parts of the body. So women going to their doctors, you know, the doctors initially didn't connect, or, well, Jenny Stock has got a painful knee, Grace Fry has got an aching back, you know, Catherine Sharp's teeth have started to fall out. They didn't join the dots at first.
And then once the women started to experience some of these symptoms, I would imagine there was such an accumulation of radium in their bodies that there really was no... there was nothing they could do at that point.
No. And to be honest, getting to that point was a huge journey in itself because, you know, as we've established at this time, radium is not seen as a culprit. You know, the medical community actually has to make quite a big leap to think, well, could it be radium hurting them? And if it is, how do we prove that? And, you know, it's actually a fascinating story from a scientific perspective. You know, there's this doctor called Harrison Martland in New Jersey. He has to invent tests to measure radioactivity in the human body for the first time in order to prove that there is radium inside the women, that when they swallowed it, it hasn't disappeared. It's inside them. And that is what is hurting them and causing these problems with their teeth or their backs or their legs or wherever it has settled in each individual dial painter. So it was a long journey scientifically, medically, for the women to actually get to a point where it was proven that radium was the culprit. And in the meantime, the women are getting sicker and sicker. And what they discover is that essentially radium is biomedically really similar to calcium. So it's what's called a bone seeker. And your listeners probably know, you know, we're encouraged to drink milk because the calcium in the milk goes into our bones, makes them nice and strong. And when the dial painters swallowed the radium acted in a similar way. It went straight to the skeleton. Mm. And there it settled, mm-hmm. like calcium does. But once it was inside their bodies, inside their bone marrow, it was there emanating this immense radioactivity. You know, they're using something called radium-226, which is the most powerful isotope of radium. It has a half-life of 1,600 years, which is, as you can imagine, devastatingly long. You know, we're talking here, these women who were hurt 100 years ago, their bodies in their graves are still being bombarded by the radium as we speak now. And what was happening is that, as I say, it was bombarding them from the inside out, basically. And so their symptoms get worse and worse because they're getting sicker and sicker. So the teeth that were aching, as I say, they start to fall out independently. Ulcers in the women's mouths, their legs and their arms start to spontaneously shorten and fracture. And when they study the women, they realize that their bones are honeycombed and moth-eaten in appearance. And they literally have holes in their bones because the radium has caused that. While these women are still alive, this is what is absolutely horrifying. You know, the level of pain is extraordinary to try and imagine. And as these women are seeking help and going to doctors and dentists and trying to make people see that there is a problem, you know, they're just sent home with aspirin, given diagnoses of rheumatism or arthritis, when actually they have been poisoned by the radium and they've got to fight for that recognition and essentially in the end for justice.
Oh, what a horrifying way to go. What a terrible death. I mean, just a terrible death. And I would imagine, so these girls are showing up at work and, you know, we all have these water cooler conversations at work. I would imagine they're all kind of comparing symptoms. And even though it might be, you know, Grace's foot and somebody else's tooth, did they start to put two and two together and that's how they began to seek justice?
Yes. Yeah. What was challenging for them is, as I say, because it would sometimes take 5 years or longer before they start to get sick, you know, not everyone stays in the same job for 5 years or longer. So a lot of the women had, you know, gone off. You know, Grace Fryer, who was a brilliant young woman, she was now working in a bank as the head of her department. You know, other women had left to have their families. And so they were sort of, you know, they dispersed. They weren't all in the studio anymore. But one of the sort of both sad and strong things about the story is that when the women had felt so lucky to get these jobs, whenever there were vacancies, they would promote the vacancies to those that they loved best, their sisters, their cousins, their friends. And so even though the women didn't work in the studios anymore, they were obviously still in touch with their sisters and cousins and friends. And yeah, Catherine Sharp said, you know, there were meetings sometimes in the dentist office of all the girls coming together, comparing notes. And as she said, we realized there was something going on about this thing. That was how she
So they were suspicious, especially since in the beginning, when they first got the job, they said, is there any danger in me sticking this brush full of radium between my lips? So there was some, suspicion from the very beginning of this story.
Very beginning. And it's important to say as well, as I say, you know, it starts quite innocently, but some women had more aggressive poisoning than others. And the very first radium girl to die, who was a woman called Molly Maggia, she died in September 1922. Mm-hmm. So quite, you know, from sort of that point onwards, people are aware that other women, former colleagues, are getting sick, are passing away. And even though they might be buried on death certificates with different things, you know, that sense of suspicion and concern deepens and grows. And the women try to band together to take action.
So as these young women are getting sick, what did the owners of the factories and the scientists at the factories, what was their response?
Well, they were worried about the rumors because it started to affect profitability.
What a surprise. That's when they started to get worried. Wow, Kate.
Yeah.
Okay.
But when there was a downturn in business, you know, women started laying down their brushes or quitting, or, you know, they're not able to replace women once they've left. They hire a sort of crack team of scientists to come and investigate at the plant. They hired the Drinkers, two brilliant scientists, a husband and wife team, who worked at Harvard. And they were brought in with another doctor called Dr. Castle to conduct a report, an investigation. They took blood from the women, they interviewed them, you know, they came and tested the paint and so on and so forth. And they issued a report that said it's the radium, at which point the company suppressed the report, refused to give them permission to publish it, and basically sit on it for another year before it eventually, the Drinkers are a bit like, you know, publish and be damned. And they eventually they publish it, regardless of the fact that the company are trying to silence it. But you've lost a whole year.
Lost a whole year of potentially saving more women. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, you guys, wanted to show you one of my favorite healthy hacks. It's actually a product called OcuShield, and I have it on my phone at all times and also on my iPad. We are inundated with blue light. Blue light is naturally occurring in sunshine, but it also, unfortunately, not so naturally occurring from our digital devices. These devices are not going away, so I just needed to figure out a way to manage the blue light in my life. It's one thing if I'm outside and it's a beautiful sunny day, that's going to send a signal to my brain of, hey, make cortisol, make stress hormones, not in a bad way, but just hormones that are going to keep me energized and active. But then at night when I go in my house and I turn my lights down, it's a signal to my body, hey, time to mellow out, time to get ready for sleep, time to make melatonin and serotonin. But the problem is you go on your phone, it sends this bright signal to your brain and your body says, oh my gosh, I thought Deb was getting ready to go to bed. Apparently she's out in the middle of the day because it's the blue light. So again, I discovered this product, OcuShield, a couple of years ago. What I like about it is it knocks the blue light down. It was created by optometrists, which is also, I think, really a key point. But what it does is it knocks the blue light down without making my screen dark or discolored. I know there's a lot of apps, and I even use that sometimes where it turns the color on my screen to dark, but then I can't see anything on my screen. So again, I'm a big fan. If you use the code DEBRA15, you can get 15% off your first purchase. I give these away to friends. I've got it on my husband's phone and iPad, and honestly, I can really tell a difference, and I love it. Hope you enjoy it. You mentioned earlier in our podcast about these women seeking justice. Can you tell us, because that seeking justice and women doesn't really go together in the 1920s. So tell us about that.
Well, again, it was a long journey because, as I say, to begin with, they couldn't, you know, because the Drinker report has been suppressed for a year, they don't have any expert connection connecting their work with their illnesses. And so they go to lawyers to say, you know, surely there's an occupational problem here. I want to sue my employer. And often the lawyers didn't believe them. They were like, well, there's no evidence here that it has, you know, that the one and the two go together. You know, as often happens even today, you know, even women going to the doctors, complaining of pain, complaining of problems, you know, it's dismissed as hysteria. The pain is not given, you know, any weight at all. You know, the radium girls experienced all of these things that women still experience.
100 years later, we are still experiencing this. Okay.
Exactly. So the fight for justice takes time, and it's largely due, I have to say, to a radium girl called Grace Fryer, who, as I say, she's the woman I mentioned earlier who rose to become the head of her department in a bank. very brilliant. Her father was a union rep. She grew up in a political house. She gave interviews where she talked about voting. So very politically, you know, civic minded young woman. And it was she who sort of just kept knocking on doors, writing to lawyers. And eventually she manages to secure the services of someone called Raymond Berry, who was a young lawyer, hadn't even reached his 30th birthday yet. And he decides to take on the case to fight for justice. And it's very hard because there's something called the statute of limitations, which is 2 years in this case. So you have to, you know, from the point of injury, you have to file suit within 2 years, which is fine if you fall off a ladder and you know exactly when you've fallen right. off a ladder and broken your leg. Because, you know, that's it. But if you've got radium poisoning and you don't start to get sick for 5 years and you haven't worked for the radium firm for four, you know, trying to square that circle is a very difficult thing to do. And some very clever legal minds, you know, did work on it. And one thing that, well, there were two arguments they made, actually. One, the fact that the company had suppressed the drinker report should mean that the company shouldn't be able to rely on the statute of limitations, because that was the point it was proven. So, you know, they shouldn't be allowed to use the delay as a defense, given they were the ones who had suppressed the evidence. And the other argument they use, which is incredibly clever, is that because the radium is inside the women's bones and hurting them anew with every second that it's emanating that radioactivity, well, that is the point of injury. So the statute of limitations is continually, you know, the clock is continually starting to tick anew because the radium is still in them and it's still hurting them, which is obviously a very clever,
very creative argument. Yes, that was brilliant. Yeah.
So thanks to Grace's perseverance and Raymond Berry's courage in deciding to take on the case, they are able to file suit and to embark on a fight for justice.
And so what ended up happening?
Well, it gets complicated because the other thing to mention is that this is not just happening in Newark, New Jersey, where Grace Fryer works. This is actually happening all over America. There were lots of different dial painting studios in different towns and cities. In my book, I mentioned three in particular: Newark in New Jersey, Waterbury in Connecticut, and Ottawa, Illinois. And the fight for justice is not simple. You know, the book is a long book. I hope it's a page-turning book, but it is a long book because I think, as anybody, you know, even now, when you try and hold large companies with lots of money and contacts in high-powered places, when you're trying to hold those kind of people to account, it's very, very difficult. And it's a long and winding
very
road.
Expensive.
To justice. And yes. Very expensive. And very hard when you're sick.
Of course.
And you're struggling. And you have medical bills, you know, coming out of your ears. So it's a long journey, and ultimately they don't get a ruling. You know, the sort of final ruling in the case doesn't really come until the late 1930s. That's essentially how long it takes, and it's a very special dial painter by that point called Catherine Donahue, who lived in Ottawa, and she was a very special person, very quiet, very unassuming, very religious. At the point she is fighting for justice, she is married with two young children, and she is very, very sick. And she is so sick that she actually collapses in the courtroom. And the doctors tell her, you know, if you continue, it might prove immediately fatal to you. And she is so determined to continue that the following day the court actually comes to her house, and she lies on her blue sofa with a blanket over her, and the lawyers and the judge sit at her round dining table in her house on East Superior Street, and she gives her evidence, you know, lying on this sofa with her lawyer sitting by her side, you know, using this very faint voice to have her day in court and to say what she needs to say. And her testimony is powerful and devastating. And the verdict, eventually we see them, you know, win the day.
The story makes me mad and sad and frustrated. And when I first read it, I cried. What we do to people for profitability.
Yeah.
What we do to people just brings me to tears, and it makes me so sad for humanity. But I'd like to think, and I'll ask you this question, have we changed? Are we telling the truth more in a workplace setting where people are exposed to toxins, or maybe people move into a neighborhood and, you know, sometimes there's a cancer cluster or something going on? Are we better at telling the truth now so that people can make an informed decision?
I think if people are forced to tell the truth, we are. But I think if there is an opportunity for some wiggle room, there is still avoidance and omission in how people are communicated with. And actually, we see that in the story of the Radium Girls over and over. You know, one of the things, you know, these dial painting studios and radium factories were in the heart of their communities, which means, you know, not only were the women's bodies mm-hmm. contaminated with the radioactive materials that they were using, but the communities were as well.
Yeah.
And in New Jersey in particular, where they would be extracting radium from the ore that they got it from, there'd be a lot of industrial waste, sand, you know, different kinds of materials. And they use that as landfill to build houses on. And there was a big scandal later in the sort of 1970s, 1980s, when they realized that all these houses that had been built on this radioactive waste were obviously still radioactive. You know, there are really high levels of radon gas, which is one of the leading causes, I think, of, you know, cancer, lung cancer, I think, in particular. And so there were big court cases again, you know, in the latter part of the 20th century, directly related to the story of the Radium Girls, from all these other innocent, you know, victims of what had gone on from, you know, decades before.
That's so interesting, because you said the life of radium is 1,000 years.
1,600
years. So of course, you know, all the leftover debris from, you know, mining this radium, it then became landfill. Yeah. So then you build a house on top of this landfill, and then you have a neighborhood of people who are getting sick.
Exactly. And, you know, there just was no consideration in the decades that followed. So in Ottawa, they used to dial paint in the old mm-hmm. high school building. In later years, that high school building became a meatpacking plant. You know, people would buy meat from there that had been stored in the same rooms where they used to store the radium. I interviewed locals who remembered when they eventually pulled the old high school building down. And, you know, there were just clouds of dust everywhere from this really highly contaminated building. People would sometimes take some of the bricks as a memento, take it home. You know, there was just no understanding. You know, I can remember Darlene, the woman I'm thinking of, telling me about this, sort of saying, you know, they had the windows open in, she was at high school, I think, when they pulled it down, and the dust sort of coming through the window. And then in later years, when they started, finally, the EPA started cleaning up, you know, those guys were all in hazmat suits. And she's like, hang on a sec, there's a disconnect here.
Right. You know? There is a massive disconnect, Kate, because the yeah. people that know that this whatever substance, fill in the blank, that when they know it's dangerous, they're prepared. But then they let yeah. us just live in it. Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly.
For whatever yeah. reason, they don't want to start hysteria. They don't want, you know, lawsuits. They want to be able to maintain their profitability. Maybe it's just too much work to go in and clean up a neighborhood where there's massive amounts of cancers.
Yeah, I mean, what was interesting again about Radium Girls is it, they started clearing things up. But it, I remember interviewing, there was another author who wrote a book called Deadly Glow. He's called Dr. Ross Molnar, incredibly helpful to me when I was researching the book. And his book about radium is also absolutely fascinating. And he was saying he was researching his book and they'd started clearing up in New Jersey. And I think they might have started clearing up in Illinois at that point. And he was like, why has nobody gone to Connecticut to do Waterbury? And it was actually him sort of saying to people, you need to look into this, that then got, you know, Waterbury cleaning up. But that was 98, I think he published his book. So, you know, really late on. And in fact, again, no one is joining, you know, it took an author who had researched it to say, hang on a sec, I think we need to, you know, investigate that and clean up that area as well. And people haven't done it until he intervened.
So even though there were three places in the U.S., Waterbury, Connecticut, New Jersey, and Illinois, two of the sites, New Jersey and Illinois, got cleaned up, you know, once they were deemed, like people were realizing there was some cancer clusters going on. But here's Waterbury, Connecticut. And it's 80 years plus since they had the factory. And it took an author doing research to say, hey, by the way, there's this.
Yeah, you might want to look into that.
So do you know, and you may not know this answer, but the citizens of Waterbury, Connecticut, did they, once they realized their area hadn't been cleaned up, did they start to get more involved in the process?
I don't know. I know it was cleaned up. I don't know how involved the citizens were or were not. But the cleanup takes years. You know, when I was researching my book, 2015, I went on a research trip to Ottawa, Illinois, and I've been back several times since. And you know, the cleanup is still going on. That's how long it takes. You know, it was sort of the 1980s that a problem was identified. And we're talking 2015 and beyond, decades, they are still there. They have to go right down, you know, because as you say, it's landfill, you know, the hole is so deep that the contamination goes. They have to dig down and then replace all the soil. You know, it's an absolutely huge job.
And then, of course, you know, it filters down into the groundwater. And then, so it sounds like we need to do our due diligence. You know, and really do research. You know, maybe when we start a new job or if it's an old building, you know, maybe trying to figure out, you know, what kinds of businesses had been in this building. And maybe even, you know, do things like get your water tested, you know, make sure your air quality, maybe you have air purifiers in your home. Is there any other advice you could give us after you doing all of this incredible research and writing this book?
Well, I think due diligence is a really good thing. You know, as you say, dig into the history and see what you can find. And I would say be vigilant and be wary because people don't always tell the truth, especially companies. You know, they do have an ulterior motive, which is usually profitability. And as you say, not wanting to admit liability. You know, one of the thing that is so sort of horribly classic about the story of the Radium Girls is that we see it, you know, we see the same story again and again. You know, when I was researching the book, looking at newspapers from the 1930s about the Catherine's Court trial in Ottawa, you know, there were adverts for cigarettes saying a cigarette a day keeps the doctor away. And obviously we know with the tobacco firms, you know, the whistleblowers that came out there to say how dangerous smoking is, you know, all the cover up and, you know, subterfuge that went on there, that it's identical to the story of the Radium Girls, you know, suppressing expert reports that prove the connection. The radium firms hired other doctors to sort of put out misleading reports, you know, to try and muddy the waters. You know, they cast doubt on the girls in terms of their sort of morals, you know, things like that. They hired private detectives to dig up dirt on them so that they wouldn't be believed, you know, just completely egregious behavior. And we see this, you know, with other firms, with other stories, with other toxins. And it is the same story again and again. And I think, as you say, it's about vigilance and it's about being wary and it's about taking inspiration from people like the Radium Girls who did persevere in trying to hold these companies to account, who did, you know, they banded together and they fought for justice together. And, you know, part of Catherine's motivation in giving that incredible testimony on her deathbed is that she knew that she had lost friends already to this, and she knew there were other workers and other women being put at risk if she didn't do it, and she wanted to fight for them and fight for a better world.
And these women, I don't want to just focus on their terrible tragedy, and because what I'm really seeing throughout this conversation we're having is their incredible courage. Yeah. Can you tell us more about what was it like to be a woman of such courage in the 20s?
Well, the thing was, you needed every ounce of that courage because, you know, because this story went on for so long. You know, think about the big moments that are happening in American history, you know, end of the 1920s, you've got the Wall Street crash, you've got the Great Depression, you know, women who are fighting to sue one of the few employers left in the middle of the Great Depression, you know, they are shunned by their communities, they're told they're liars and cheats and frauds. You know, I found sort of interviews with local townspeople that had actually been recorded in the 1970s, and they were still casting doubt on the Radium Girls who had died and still saying, well, she always looked sick, you know, even in the 1970s, even though they won their case, even though it was completely proven that radium had hurt them, the, you know, some of the community interviews were still saying, no, they were frauds, they were liars, you know, they were sick to begin with. They were just trying to pull one over on the company. So the women really needed courage because it wasn't like they were hailed as heroes by their communities. Not at all. They were shunned. And one other point that I want to make that we haven't talked about in terms of the physical effect on them, you know, I mentioned earlier that some people started to get sick after 5 years. In some, it would be decades later. The really sort of frightening and horrifying thing really about radium poisoning is that it could lie dormant in the Radium Girls for decades, and then they would start to get something called a sarcoma, which is a kind of bone tumor basically, and it can grow anywhere in the body. It can grow on your hip, your elbow, your eye sockets, and it's a huge cancerous mass basically, and it was like a ticking time bomb inside them, because if you'd been a dial painter, you were at risk of developing one, but you didn't know when or where it might get you. And depending on where it grew, you know, you were lucky if you got one in your elbow because you could have your arm amputated. But if it was in the middle of your body, there was absolutely nothing that could be done for you. And so, you know, because we're talking about cancer today, this was one of, you know, as I say, it's like a horrible serial killer. That's how I sort of talk about it in the book, that it have evolved its, you know, modus operandi. And it, the early girls didn't die from sarcomas, but the later women did.
Oh, wow. What a horrible legacy that was left for these women. And of course, it's also going to cause changes to your DNA, which you then pass down to the children that you have. Yeah.
Yeah. And there was, I mean, a bit like the way the women were affected differently, people always ask about the children. And from the very small cohort of women that I studied for the book, there were differences with their children as well. So I think particularly if a woman had her babies quite early, you know, quite soon after leaving the studio, perhaps she'd only dial painted for a couple of years. She perhaps wasn't sick when she was gestating her babies. Those children tended actually to be fine. And I was lucky enough to interview some, you know, sons and daughters for the book who were in their 80s and 90s in robust, good health. Mm-hmm. You know, so they were okay, but you know, other women struggled to conceive, had miscarriages, you know, and perhaps the children might be born small or premature, or died young. And so you got a real mix, which in a way is almost, is also human biology, because we all, you know, as I'm sure you know from, you know, doing this podcast, you and I could get exactly the same dose of radiation from being a dial painter, and our bodies would respond in a different way.
Which was part of the challenge, of course, because if they'd all had a tumor on their elbow within 6 months, maybe things would have happened a little differently. But I have to say, I'm just so impressed by the courage of these women. And I'm just so grateful that you told this story. You were a voice for them. And it is one of the most fascinating, but again, heartbreaking stories and books that I have ever had an opportunity to be exposed to. But I just want to thank you for the work that you have done here. And it is very clear that you have done probably thousands of hours of research to tell this story in a way that's really going to connect with people. And hopefully people will ask more questions and do their own due diligence. Yes.
Hopefully they'll get honest answers. And one thing I do want to say, you know, you thanked me for being the voice for these women. What was incredible about researching the book is I didn't have to be their voice because their voices were still there in the archives. So what's sort of amazing about the book is it's filled with first person material from the Radium Girls, from their letters, their diaries, their court testimonies, their newspaper interviews. You know, if you read the book, you're actually hearing from Grace Fryer and Catherine Sharp, Catherine Donahue. It isn't my voice. And I always say I feel really strong. I used to do ghostwriting before I wrote the Radium Girls. And I think both the way I approach this book and the way I feel about it is that I was like their ghostwriter. You know, my job was to research their story and find their words. And then I've just put it together in the book. But the voices that you hear when you read the book are their voices telling you their story in their own words. And that's why I'm so proud of it, because it's, you know, it's a platform for them to tell you what they went through and what they did.
Well, the book is just a gift. So I just thank you so much for telling us this story in such easy to understand terms, because, you know, it involves a lot of chemicals and, you know, different types of cancer, and you've just made it really easy to understand. And, but what really comes through in this book and in this conversation today is just the courage that these women had. And I just thank you for sharing that with us.
It's my pleasure and my privilege. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about them.
Hey everyone, a lot of you have been asking me about the products I use on my face. I've never been one to get a lot of compliments on my skin, but I tell you, since I switched over to this product, it's been about 10 years now, I get so many compliments on my skin, and I want to keep that going. So Body Deli is what I use. It's a small company out of Palm Springs, California. They grow a lot of their own produce that they then end up turning into products for your face. Non-toxic. I mean, honestly, my skin just eats it up. So there's a couple of products that I absolutely love. I've tagged them in the show notes. One is the Phoenix Skin and Neck Oil. I mean, I'm at that age. I need to focus on these things. And I tell you, if I don't use this every night, my skin gets so dry. And then the vitamin C serum, I tell you, whenever I put it on my skin, I feel like it's just like taking this amazing vitamin and my skin just looks better. I get compliments. As I said, my skin kind of just, you know, glows even when I'm not wearing makeup. So I'm a huge fan of Body Deli. Again, the link is in the show notes. Use the code ENOS15 and get 15% off of your purchase. Again, one of my favorite companies, and I hope you enjoy the products as much as I do. By now, most of us are aware that there are EMFs radiating coming out of our phones, out of our headphones, earbuds, you name it. So I don't want to be paranoid, but I want to be safe, and I want to try to knock down the radiation as much as I can. And so this is one of the reasons why I use a company. It's called WaveBlock. I actually met the owner, Ben Salem, probably 2 years, meeting on Instagram, if that's considered meeting. And he created this product because he saw that his kids had earbuds in all day long. And this was during the pandemic, and they were out riding their bikes, they were doing school. And he tested, and he realized there is a tremendous amount of radiation coming from headphones. So he created a product that effectively knocks down the radiation. And I'm still going to use my AirPods. I maybe don't use them as much as I used to. I try to use wired headphones, which I've heard can also knock radiation down. But what we have to learn to do is we have to learn to manage technology so that it doesn't end up hurting us. Technology is not going away. So there's a lot of things that I do, including putting a wrap on my phone that is going to help to knock the radiation down. Like I said, wrapping my headphones with something called Wave Block. I've got a code, it's ENOS10, and the information is going to be in the show notes. If you want to try this product and get 10% off, I highly recommend it. I've been using it for a couple of years, and I actually bought it for my husband and my kids and my nephews. And anyway, it's something that I think can really help moving forward to lower the negative impact of these technological devices that are not going away. We're all going to continue to use them. So hope you enjoy it. Thank you for joining me today on the Why Did I Get Cancer podcast. I've got my shopping guide for all of my cancer self-care items in the show notes, along with information about today's guest and our show sponsors. And don't forget to subscribe to my podcast so you never miss an episode. Keep in mind, I'm not a doctor. I'm just a gal that got diagnosed with cancer and wanted answers. If you need medical advice, please be sure to consult with a medical professional. And thank you for listening.